And we'll be alternating a little bit between people in the room and people on Zoom. So,
is there a difference between loving kindness and compassion?
So the question is there a difference between loving kindness and compassion? There is a difference, yes. I mean, the English words are a little, not that they don't quite line up with the actual teaching that the Buddha's giving. So metta, you know, you can think of it as loving kindness. Sometimes you can just call it acceptance, friendliness. It's sort of a warmth and a radiance. And it's very much just like loving everything, because why not? It's like that. Everything needs love. Everyone needs love. Any love, and so that love is for everything, radiating in all directions. And karuna or compassion is specifically related to suffering. So you know, we translated karuna as karuna is the Pali word, and then we translated that as compassion. Is it not quite? It's not quite the right word. So compassion literally means to suffer with another, compassion, so to suffer with in the Latin. And there's another word in Pali, anukampa, which literally means that, to tremble with, literally means to tremble with, where you're resonating with another. And that's in, when you read the Buddha's teachings, that's more around when you're, that's more in sort of daily life activity, when you feel that somebody else's struggle, or you maybe you resonate with the difficulties of another. And in the meditation practice, it's a little bit slightly different to that. So there's this word karuna, and karuna is connected with wishing that all beings are free from harm and any intention to harm. So it's like going right to the root of suffering in a way. So wishing that all beings be free. It can be as a phrase or just as an intention of the heart, that all beings avoid the suffering that arises from being harmed or from causing harm. So that's the root of karuna. So it's a little bit different. And then as you practice, you know, it is an energy field that one generates in the heart center. And all four Brahma Viharas are a little bit different. They have like a bit of a different tone, each one. Yeah. So there's also, since we're talking about, there's also mudita. So there's metta, karuna, mudita, and upeka. And mudita is like appreciative joy. It's a sense of, it's also a resonance with, but it's like celebrating the goodness, you know, like having joy for the beauty of nature, you know, feeling mudita, feeling like empathic joy for a beautiful connection between a mother and baby, you know, those lovely, when they're gazing at each other, you know, it's like feeling a sense of mudita joy for that, or just seeing somebody looking well and happy, like just making me feel well and happy, you know, there's that sense of responding with empathic joy, yeah, sympathetic joy. And then upeka is the big picture. Upeka is a sense of like being okay with things as they are, being loving, accepting with things as they are. So understanding, you know, everyone that is born must die. This is just how it is. Everything that comes together has to fall apart. This is just the way it is. And it's also a quality when we get very caught up in our little story of me and mine, then we can maybe go outside and look at the night sky, if you're in a place where you can do that. It's powerful. And it's like, wow, it's vast. And all of those stars, those are suns. There's like countless suns up there in the sky. And then, you know, we're just in this one galaxy that we can see a little bit. You know, you can see the Milky Way, you can see a bit of the galaxy, and then that's just one of maybe trillions of galaxies. And it's like amazing what they're discovering now. So then that takes us out of the little story of me and mine and my troubles and my suffering into this just vast, vast expanse of like, oh, there's so much more. And I don't have to be focused on this little thing here. So that also brings a sense of upeka, that sense of context, really. So upeka is a bit like having the bird's eye view, big view of things. It's not trying to make everything flat. But it's having room for the ups and downs. Thank you. No questions? And also just to say, you know, I sit up here. Yeah, I don't have notes. You know, I speak from my practice. And I'm, you know, like I was extremely shy when I was young. It was extremely stressful to sit in front of people and speak. And it's not, I mean, I'm over it now. It's fine. But, you know, it's not always comfortable. And so I'd like to invite you to be courageous too and to speak up. And don't think like, oh, maybe my question's silly. You know, if it's meaningful to you, then ask it. Even if it's the simplest question in the world, sometimes that's really important. So it doesn't have to be profound or impressive. We're not here to impress each other, but we're here to wake up. Thanks. Katie.
Can I keep this on?
I can hear you, yes.
Okay, I've practiced a lot of metta for like hours and hours. I've just done bits of it. And I tried to just do the meditation. I found it very intense. I don't do well with the breath. I have some control issues with the breath. I don't really know what they are, but I tried to do it instead, and it's felt very mechanical, breathing energy and breathing out.
Okay.
But it was very sweet, but then it was strong, and that's getting kind of tired in a way.
Right.
Does that
okay.
make sense?
Yes, it does, yes. So Katie, is it?
Mm.
So it's just about really, just about.
Oh.
So Katie was saying that the practice that I was teaching, so that she's, for those of you who are listening in, they're from afar, the practice of metta is something that she's done a little bit here and there, but not for hours, not like a long time, like I've been guiding today. And that the practice became very intense, and that the sense of breathing in and then breathing in metta and breathing out, letting it spread, became mechanical. And so some dissonance there with the practice, like it's not leading to a greater sense of well-being and relaxation, letting go, which is part of the fruit of the practice. When those wholesome states arise. So I think a lot of people do metta for like 10 minutes at the end of the practice. So that's good. But I understand the metta practice as being, you know, in the way the Buddha taught it, as being something to really cultivate as a resource, as a field here in our heart mind to meet the many challenges of the world. So that we're not trying to control the world to be the way we need it to be so that we feel okay, but we feel well, and therefore we can meet the world as it is. So that's how I understand the teaching to be around metta. And my experience is, in order to do that, you have to really kind of dedicate some time to it. It doesn't work just to have a few minutes and then move on. And that's also been my practice. You know, certainly in the first years of practice, I spent a lot of time practicing with metta, many hours practicing with metta, you know, long periods of retreat, really focused on that as a means to transform the hatred, the fear, the smallness of my own heart. That's my experience. I'm not saying that anyone else has all of that, but that was my experience. So it sounds like what you're doing is, the beginning is really good. You know, you're connected, you're staying with it. And so I just need to clear my throat. So it sounds like you're connected with it, and it's accessible. And then maybe what's missing is a sense of making a bit more space. So there's maybe a bit too much focus, a bit too much doing. And this practice that I'm guiding to, it begins with doing. You start by doing metta. It begins that way because that's what people used to do. They're used to doing metta practice. So you begin doing, and then you make space, and it shifts into being. So it shifts into a state of just being, so being metta. So if you're feeling the energy in the heart, which sounds like it's quite strong and quite intense, I would suggest having a sense of greater spaciousness. I don't know if that's accessible, but and letting that quality not just build up here, but letting it just open up and radiate out, not pushing it out. You're not trying to do it, but you're just allowing it to radiate. And with the breath, again, it's not like trying to do anything or make anything happen. It's more like the breath is happening, the body is breathing, and then it's easy to just sort of drift off without something that one can stay with. So the breath, just the natural experience of the breath can bring, I find, anyway, can bring my attention into the heart center, because it's breathing into here. So it brings the attention to the heart center, and then there can just be, it's just like more like a gentle invitation to let it spread out. So it doesn't, it's not like, okay, stronger and then out. It's not like a, there's no force involved. It's more like a way of staying connected and centered, and then it's more like an invitation, actually. So I think a lot of people, and I certainly did that, with the metta practice, that there's this kind of like trying to do it and trying to make it really big, and it gets exhausting, you know. And so less doing and more being is the what I would like to say. Yes, Bill.
I have no idea how the sound quality will be for those people. This is a question from Lisa, and I'll just read it aloud. Just asked, often I am deeply moved when practicing metta meditations. On the other hand, maybe I am reaching a deeper concentration or letting go. On the other hand, maybe I am creating a sort of emotional story. I guess I am not sure about trusting, having faith in these periods of being so deeply moved.
Thank you. So one thing just to acknowledge, that there's a little bit of doubt in there. It's like, oh, it may be this, or maybe that, or maybe this, I'm not sure. So that's good to know. When doubt arises, it's good to know it as doubt, because doubt is one of the hindrances to awakening. So I just want to mention those five hindrances, because they come up all the time. So sensual desire, wanting something lovely. Ill will, wanting to get rid of. Sleepiness and dullness, so like sleepiness of mind and lethargy of the body, restlessness and agitation, or restlessness and worry, a sense of like can't sit still and worrying about the future, and then doubt, like, and doubt can arise in many ways, in many forms, like, oh, should I do this or should I do that? Is this right or is this wrong? So doubt is that, like, not being able to settle with something. And these are all part of what sort of, they're called the hindrances. So they hinder us from just resting in the present. So once we know them, there's no problem. So they're actually one of the focuses for mindfulness. So it's fun to know them. So just acknowledging, I recognize a bit of doubt in there, like, this. And so the quality of metta, it does lead to settling. So if there are lots of stories, and then the stories, I mean, let's just step back a few steps, but it can be useful. If you have a painful story, it can be useful to bring that into the field of metta once you've generated some. It can be really good, and it can help to transform difficult relationships. So that's one way of working with a story. But if it's more like you're getting really blissed out, then there's all of these like ideas and thoughts and visions, and then maybe there's a little bit of a loss of groundedness or centeredness. And I think the breath helps to bring one back into presence, because the breath is always happening here and now. And maybe just to see, can you settle back into the heart? You know, is there some, you know, is this, in a way, it's like, I'm just kind of using the kind of quite coarse words, but, you know, sometimes it can be greed, you know, it's like that we want something wonderful and then, oh, I have this wonderful meditation, it's so gorgeous, you know, it can be like that, and it's like, it's great, you know, it's lovely, but, you know, maybe there's a bit of greed in there too, and you know, the metta practice, it is, I mean, it can be very ebullient, you know, it does open us up, it is limitless, and it's boundless, it's beautiful, it's loving. But it's also natural. It's. I don't mean it's easy to access always, you know, because there's often things in the way. But like for those, you know, in the stages of awakening, for those who've kind of done a lot of work and cleared out a lot of delusion, the four Brahmaviharas become a natural way of relating to the world. So it's like what's there, in a way, it's like what's left when we take away all of the stuff that we have on top. So to dwell in metta, it is more of a state of being. It can be very blissful. And it certainly can lead into samadhi, can lead into concentration states. It's not the way I use it personally, but it can. But it's something that one can abide in. It is one of the abidings, divine abidings. It's like a beautiful place to dwell. So if it's very complex or getting too jazzy or too like colourful or whatever, then maybe there's a bit of an add-on there. And see whether you can just simply come back to the quality of metta. And maybe also it could be good to shift to karuna, you know, because with karuna, just wait a moment. A few moments. Maybe I won't wait. Might take a little while. So with karuna, we're taking in some of the difficult realities of the world, and that can help to, you know, if the metta is getting too like ebullient, then shifting to karuna, that can help to just change the tone a little. You know, we're also bringing in the, you know, the fact of the difficulties of the world, and it's like, oh yeah, there's that. And then that bringing up this sense of just wishing that all beings be free from suffering or the causes of suffering. So with the Brahmaviharas, you can shift between the four. So I would suggest that. And is it this? Is it that? We'll probably just keep you in doubt. We just keep going around and around. And it's probably better to settle and center. And then you can also shift to a slightly different Brahmavihara practice. So I hope that's helpful. Rather long answer. Anyone else? Yes, Hannah, thank you.
Can you talk about reading metta inward versus outward? And for those of us, for one, might be easier than
the other. So the question is about radiating metta inward rather than outward
for those of us where one might be a lot easier than the other.
For those who are one might be easier than another. So it's very, very common for it to be difficult for people to take in the metta. So you know, the interesting thing about this particular practice that the Buddha gives is it starts right here in the center of your heart. And so for it to go anywhere, it's kind of got to go through you. It starts with you, actually. There's no way around it. But the beauty of it is you don't have to create a story of you. You don't have to say, I have metta for myself, even though I'm like this, I do all those things wrong. You don't need to bring that story in. It's just metta. And then in the same as it goes, as it comes out of, you know, as it carries on out, it's not like, oh, I'm having metta for in this particular practice, it's not like metta for my teachers, my parents, my friends, my people I don't know, my enemies. That's a later addition. That's that in Burma they created this system, which is very, very useful. It's a very good practice, but that wasn't what the Buddha was pointing to. It was much more universal quality. So it's kind of bypassing the stories altogether, and I don't mean spiritual bypassing. I mean it's just like not getting involved in the stories, and it's just there for the benefit of all beings. And so my experience with that particular practice is that it just starts here, and you know, if it dares to come out a little bit, then it, you know, whatever cells it's touching are influenced by that. And if you can get it to go right through the whole of the body and out, then every cell in your body is influenced by that. So that's kind of how it works. And it may be that, so, you know, I didn't start practicing in this way. I'd done other metta practices for quite a while before I did this one. And then a bit later on, I met someone who pointed out that it was the way the Buddha taught this way. So it's like, oh, that's great. I sort of found my way to it, but didn't know that it was kosher, basically. And then it was like, oh, it's okay. But it might be, you know, sometimes we have to, well, anyway, I would say that it's very good with metta to be creative and find your own ways of what works. And with this phenomena that so many of us have of, you know, we can have so much kindness for so many beings and be really lovely people, and you know, everyone else thinks we're great, and then the internal experience is horrible, and we're so self-critical that we can't accept ourselves. You know, it's very, very common. It was very, very strong for me when I first started to practice. One of the really important things to do is to, you know, to see the way we speak to ourselves, internal speak, and then would we say that to anyone else? And then we see how we judge ourselves for making a mistake. Would we judge somebody else for making that same mistake in the same way? My experience was like, no way, you know, I would never speak. I would be fine. Like, oh, it's okay. You know, we're all human. But if I do it, then, nah, you know. So basically, the practice is to bring oneself into the circle of the human race. That's what it is, you know, it's just be one of the people in the circle. We're just the same as everybody else. We don't have to be better, we're not worse, we're just another human being. And we make mistakes, and we see everything inside ourselves, and we don't see what's going on inside each other. And there's a lovely reflection that I learned. I used to teach support a teacher actually at an AA group in England. It was like a sangha, Alcoholics Anonymous sangha. And the guy Billy, the guy who was leading it, I remember him saying to me one day, "Don't judge your inside by other people's outside." And I was like, "Well, that's so cool. That's such a good teaching, because we do that all the time." Close up here, and it's like we see all the things that are wrong, and then we think if people really knew us, you know, they wouldn't really like us. You know, there's all of that goes on, and then we see the outside of someone else, and we think that's real, and this is real. Actually, none of it's real. And then, you know, so don't judge your inside by other people's outside. Don't compare it, and bring yourself into the circle. Be just part of the circle. We're all very fallible. Even the Buddha made like huge mistakes, fully enlightened. Mistakes we would hope we would never make, but you know. So, you know, we're all just fallible human beings. And and it can be also helpful to have, they actually know now with there's so much knowledge about the way the brain works now that we didn't have a few years ago, like even 20 years ago. One of the things I was learning recently, it was a psychologist who had specialized in compassion, and she was saying that a relational response. So in order for the whatever little lights to go off, you know, for compassion in the brain, for a compassionate response, there has to be two or more. It's So to say, to just try to be kind to myself without a sense of separating that out doesn't really work that well. So, because I used to do this practice when I was struggling a lot, of like, okay, I'm put myself there, out there, and then I'll have compassion for myself over there. And it always seemed a bit crazy. It's like, it's kind of a little crazy, I'm making these two people, you know. But now I realize, like, oh, actually, that's how it works. You kind of need to do that. It doesn't work just to try and be like, come on, be kind, you know, it's like to put yourself into that circle and then see, like, oh, yeah, look at how much she's suffering, actually. I don't want her to suffer like that, you know. And then it's like that compassion arises. And it has its own wisdom, you know, when we start to do that, it guides you. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for asking. I think you've asked on behalf of many people, actually. Yeah, that's how.
I have a question.
Please, Margaret.
It's like judgment, I guess, but it comes up like I've been opening myself more up to the world in the last few years.
Yes.
And then let's say I do that server here and I feel like, well, I have this thing like I'm only able to do this or because I'm comfortable. Like I'm kind of in a more comfortable place in my life right now. I know it's not gonna last forever. I know something's gonna happen in a little way or big ways, but still, like that comes up, and it's I don't know what it is, if it's judgment or what it is. And as I was listening to you and wondering about this, I don't know, is that the antidote actually gratitude that I do have the fortune, the good fortune to be able to practice or. To be able to be open. I mean, sometimes I feel like I'm maybe more accepting, again, because I'm comfortable. And not everybody is comfortable.
Yes, thank you. So for those of you on Zoom, that was kind of a dilemma sort of question around... No, it's one can practice metta in a setting like this, you know, because one's comfortable and one's life is comfortable, and the sense of comfort enables the metta to vertige, and then the dilemma of like what to do about that, you know. And the question about, you know, is gratitude an antidote? And in a way, gratitude is not an antidote, but it's another wholesome quality. It's always good. Gratitude is always good. It's never wrong. And it's always helpful. But I would say the way to work with that is, I mean, I would guess, even if you have a comfortable life, I would guess that sometimes you run into difficult relationships. Sometimes people really annoy you. Sometimes you watch the news and you wish that certain people weren't doing what they're doing or didn't have the power they had. So I would guess that there are things that have come up in your life that are not particularly comfortable and that are challenging and, you know, that maybe you don't always respond with metta. I don't know. Maybe you do. So those are the times to work at it. So it's like you can cultivate, it's good to cultivate it when things are supportive and easy, and that's a great time to do that work. And it can be really helpful to be in an environment that's safe and supportive. And then you can, once you get that quality of metta going, you can bring in difficult scenarios or difficult relationships and work on them. So that's actually really helpful. That's a very good way of doing it. So you know you're safe, nothing terrible is going to happen, and then you work on the sort of sticky, difficult relationships that may be still around in your life, if you have any. I mean, And so that's one thing. And then just when difficulties arise, you know, just to see what is responding. Is it, you know, can you respond? Is it, you know, I noticed for myself, I mean, I live in a community, so people give feedback. So, you know, and like we all think we are one thing, and then the people who live with us have a different view of what's going on. You know? So just recently had this feedback from three of the people I live with closely, and it was the same from each of them, at the same, all together, in a very kind, it was done quite, it wasn't too difficult, but it was like, wow, I didn't even know. And then one of them was saying, so why do you do that? And I'm like, I don't even know I was doing it, you know. It was like a sort of like a bit of an aggressive responding to things. And then one of them said, stress. And I'm like, ah, that makes sense. So it's like, okay, so when I'm stressed, a rather abrasive and maybe a bit dismissive way, which I wasn't aware of, you know, until my good friends told me. And so those are things, like if you're in a relationship or with friendships, you know, make the invitation to learn about how you affect people at certain times, and then it's the case of just like, okay, I'm gonna work on that area. What's going on? You know, is there fear? Is there overwhelm? Is there resentment? You know, and instead of responding in that habitual way, I'm just kind of speaking to myself now also, to respond with, you know, can I respond with patience and kindness instead? Can I just take a moment? So it's really just to bring in the times that are challenging, not to exclude them from the practice. And then to use the comfortable, supportive times to generate the quality. And like you said, you know, good conditions probably aren't going to last forever. I mean, they might, you know, but they may not. And so you cultivate now so that you have a resource here for when the difficulties arise. Does that make sense? Okay, thank you. So we could have one more, or we could move on. If there's one more question, I'd be happy to answer. Oh, there's two. Okay, I'll answer both. Yes, Mo.
I've been thinking a lot about the quality of empathy, which it seems like to me it's a natural state. If it's not for most people who aren't mentally ill, but that some people live in such a way that they don't have the capacity to go there. Because they're too overwhelmed by fear or whatever. And I just think we're really in trouble that people can't cultivate that quality just as a social reality of how they live in the world. And, you know, also it leads to a sense of connectedness with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I choose to believe that it's our natural state, but that it gets occluded by places.
Mm-hmm.
Is that different from compassion?
Thank you, Mo. So Mo was as in the sense of it, and the problem of people not having empathy through overwhelm, or through basically the kilesas or the obscurations of mind being too strong, you know, greed, hatred, and delusion. Very simply put. That is a problem. It's a big problem in our world. I'm not sure if I sort of lost the last bit now. What was the last
bit? Well, I'm thinking about it in terms of Brahma Viharas.
Oh, yeah. Is it the same as Karuna? Yeah. That's right. So Venerable Anālaya has a lot to say about karuna and empathy, and he's very clear that they're not the same. And it comes back to what I was saying a bit earlier about the to you about the compassion, the karuna, and then the word compassion. Compassion is an empathic response. And mudita is also an empathic response. Mudita is having empathy for other people's good fortune or for the beauty of what's around one. And karuna is a little bit slightly different to that. Karuna is this deep wish. It's very, very centered. It's like, so before I really understood this, for me, karuna was this like, oh, it's like the heart is out. And it's like feeling the suffering of the world. And sometimes it's like really overwhelming, you know, because there's so much suffering. And then karuna, as I learned it, then I was on a long retreat with Venerable Anālaya, who's a very deep practitioner and scholar, a Buddhist scholar. And we didn't agree on this. First of all, he pointed out the difference, and I'm like, no, I think that's not like that. And so I didn't agree, and we sort of agreed to disagree. And then he gave a guided meditation where see the difference. And so with karuna, there is this quality. It's very, very grounded in the heart. It's not doing that. It's not reaching forward. It's not spilling out. It's not hurting, because it can be painful to open to the suffering of the world. So it's not hurting. It's not trembling with, but it's just this deep wish. It's like it's almost like it's there before all of the stuff happens. There's this deep wish that. To be free from harm, for all beings to be free from harm, including this one, and any intention to harm. So it goes right to the root of suffering, really. And it's a different place. So it isn't empathy, karuna, no. It's more like, or if it is empathy, it's an empathy for the human state, just really understanding the human state and wishing that, you know, it doesn't have to be that messy. It doesn't have to be that painful. And just wishing like that just go right to the root and just don't feed that stuff. It's kind of like that. Zoom people. It's difficult with a robe to wear this kind of clip-on mic. And yes, you know, I think empathy, like a sense of resonance with each other, is very much a human quality. And you know, there are a few people who are born without it or who grow up without it, and it is a dangerous thing to not have that. So yes, I think it is natural. So, good one. All right. So let's have some more time in meditation. Let's just sit with all of that. Find your posture for meditation. Again, if you find that you're feeling sleepy, you can just stand, and it's quite good to stand just behind your chair if you have a chair, and then it stops you from falling over. It gives you a little stability. So feeling the contact of your body with the ground and with your seat. Coming down from the head into the body. Feeling your feet on the floor or your butt on the cushion on the seat. and feeling the space above and around you. Feeling the connection between us all of us who have gathered here at the center, and everyone who's gathered from your homes on Zoom. Just feeling the connection that's brought us together to practice together today. We're all different, we're all very unique. And we're all human. We're all kind of similar in some ways. I can't help, having said that, I can't help also bringing in our standing relatives outside, the trees, plants. We're all breathing together. We're always very aware of the trees. Some of the most generous beings on the earth. And many creatures, all sorts of shapes and sizes. We're all sentient beings, we're all living, feeling beings. We're all breathing. And every being, every living being wants safety. Wants to be free from harm and wants to have well-being. And sometimes that gets a bit twisted, convoluted. But essentially, you know, even an amoeba, even a one-celled living being, we'll move away from harm and move towards comfort, safety. It's an essential movement of life. So understanding that all beings wish to have safety, wish to have happiness and the causes of happiness, wish to have well-being and to be safe. Just recognize, just take a moment and recognize that. Feel that in your heart, in your body, in your belly. And recognizing that universal wish of all beings to have happiness and the causes of happiness. You can have that intention, whether you use it as a phrase or just as an intention, but it's important that it moves from your head to your heart or your belly. Belly is also a good place. And then may all beings be free from harm and any intention to harm. You might notice, you might see that there have been times in your life, and maybe not, but maybe so, where you've had an intention to harm, had harmful intentions towards someone or people, beings. It is inherently suffering. And certainly if that harm is acted upon, those harmful intentions are acted upon, just creates more and more harm. So this is a way of living in the world that increases suffering for oneself and for others. And we don't have to do that anymore. So with a deep understanding of that painful mind state, understanding that it's, you know, that it's conditioned and it's painful and it leads to more pain. We have that deep wish, may this being and all beings be free from harm and any intention to harm. See if you can connect with that quality in your heart, not just as a thought, in your heart or in your belly. So I'd like to invite you to go into movement meditation now for 20 minutes. Walking meditation, if you can do walking, and you might want to do also just a little bit of stretching, movement, whatever works for you, and just as long as there's mindfulness, it's all good. And there'll be a bell at 1:30 the hour.